what do you want to see in the short term? What do you think is going to be positive impact for you to measure? What do you think the wider community is going to benefit from in the medium term? And then what is the systemic change that you want to achieve in the longer term? And the way that it's sort of articulated on the Social Business Model Canvas reflects across to beneficiaries, to customers, and to funders also.
Welcome to the From Passion to Action podcast, a discussion about social innovation and social entrepreneurship from Dublin City University. I'm Dr. Eimear Ní Bhradh.
I'm Donica Kinlan.
And I'm Meeta Power. In this series, we talk to academic experts in social innovation and entrepreneurship, social entrepreneurs who have founded their own social enterprises, and community organizations that are contributing to meaningful social change.
The aim of these conversations is to delve into the concepts of social innovation and entrepreneurship in theory and in practice, to discuss why they are important in today's society, and above all, to explore ways to embed these concepts in higher education across different disciplines.
The From Passion to Action project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. We hope that you enjoy sharing these materials as well with your colleagues and with your students. With me today is Dr. Denise Crossan, who is originally from Ireland and is now working in Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. And she's working there as the visiting Lang Professor for Issues for Social Change. And you're very welcome, Denise, today to our podcast about social innovation and entrepreneurship as part of the From Passion to Action project. So we're very interested in your experiences on both sides of the Atlantic. So perhaps you could explain a little bit more what your job is as visiting Lang Professor for Issues for Social Change.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. Yes, so I am the visiting professor for Issues for Social Change. And what that means is I'm technically hosted by Peace and Conflict Studies here in Swarthmore College, and also co-hosted by a center called the Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility. And just very quickly, Swarthmore College is a small liberal arts college that's located about 14 miles from Philadelphia. It's a very academic oriented institution. It's a Quaker founded organization. And so we are very much of a Quaker ethos in how we do things. And because it's liberal arts, we have this wonderful curriculum that pulls from so many interdisciplinary subjects that feed into this topic of social innovation, social entrepreneurship, and peace and conflict studies. So I'm very fortunate to be here. I came in 2015. Trinity let me go. Trinity College Dublin School of Business let me go for a year. And in fact, I ended up staying 6 years. So I'm actually coming to the end of my Lang professorship now and looking to the future to see what's next.
That's very interesting. It's very interesting you mentioned that Swarthmore has a background with the Quakers, because they would be quite well known in Ireland as being, one could say, social entrepreneurs with the development in Letterfrack in Galway and Ballitore and so on. So that's nice to see that connection. What I'd like to ask you, Denise, before we delve in a bit more into your work in Swarthmore, is we like to ask each of our guests the same three questions. So the first one is, what's the first word that you think of when you hear the concepts of social innovation and social entrepreneurship?
I think of community. That's the first word that comes into my head. Community, community empowerment, community taking action to improve their circumstances for themselves, and the whole self-help movement. Social innovation and social entrepreneurship is rooted in community for me.
Okay. So that would be your own understanding of social innovation and social entrepreneurship?
I see social innovation and social entrepreneurship as processes that allow communities to act better for themselves, to use limited resources that they have, to be able to create solutions so that they can respond to the needs that they have themselves. And social innovation and social entrepreneurship, social innovations are solutions that aren't necessarily commercialized, but allow people in communities to use resources better to create better circumstances for themselves, whereas social entrepreneurship is individuals who apply entrepreneurial skill sets to be able to achieve a social mission And in the process of creating that entrepreneurial model, they reinvest any profits or surplus profits they might have back into their community or their social mission. So one thing I would add, though, is I would also put in social enterprise in there. I often differentiate between social enterprise and social entrepreneurship. And for me, again, touching on this idea of community at the basis of all of these things, for a social enterprise, you have a group of community members who have identified a social problem that they want to tackle. And over time, you know, evolve their income model to include more entrepreneurial kinds of activity to increase tradable income. For me, social entrepreneurs are usually one or two individuals that sort of begin their business and their social mission at the same time. So I see this differentiation between social innovation as a non-commercialized community activism that creates better solutions, social enterprise, a group of community members getting together to tackle a social problem, and ultimately creating many different kinds of models of enterprise to supplement their income sources to sustain the activity. And entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, as people who start from the get-go with a business and a social mission at the same time.
Okay, very good. So the whole idea of community is very important, but then there's also the individuals who might come together with a new idea for better good, for better social good. Yeah.
Right.
What drew you to social entrepreneurship? Or, you know, can you tell me about your career history? How did you end up where you are working in this field?
As with many things, I think as I now reflect back on all of the work that I've done in this space, it's just luck. Luck in a lot of ways. I graduated with a degree in geography from Queen's University in Belfast in the early 90s, and thought at the time that I wanted to be a teacher, that that's what I would go on and do. Throughout my degree in geography, realized that's probably not what I wanted to do, which is a little ironic now that I am teaching. But left the Queen's, decided I wanted to do business, did a postgrad diploma in quality management systems. But what was most importantly happening at the time in Northern Ireland, where I was growing up, was the peace process was beginning. And there was a lot of conversation around how do we create an economy that the community can build to be able to create a better environment for themselves as a measure towards creating peace effectively. You know, you're familiar with John Hume, who was our MEP at the time, a leading politician and sort of one of the creators of the peace agreement and the infrastructure around the peace process in Northern Ireland. And he was very much of the mindset that in order to regenerate a community and to end conflict, you really have to think about the mechanisms that allow community to do self-help, to support themselves, right? The community understands the issues that they're facing. They also understand the resources that they have available to them and how to maximize those to create opportunity for themselves. So I was very fortunate in that I was kind of not really knowing what I wanted to do. And simultaneously, the peace process was beginning. The special program for peace and reconciliation was constructed. The European Union and other countries were investing in Northern Ireland to create peace. And I was one of the first, recruited as one of the first community business advisors in Northern Ireland to work on that particular pillar of the peace program, which was creating community business in local communities on the ground with grassroots community members to help them think about self-sustainable self-action.
Okay, so it's very much rooted in community development.
Yes.
Yeah, that's excellent. So what role do you see for social enterprise and social entrepreneurship in society? Do you think that has taken root in Northern Ireland? How have you any examples of how it has helped?
Yeah, well, I think this is a really fascinating question, because I think sometimes we think of social innovation and social entrepreneurship as some kind of new phenomenon. And, you know, research has shown us that, you know, this is actually something that's gone on for, you know, hundreds of years, if not longer, centuries. In fact, Jack DeForney has a great paper where he describes social innovation and social entrepreneurship structures from the Egyptian times, for example, and Greeks and Romans, you know, setting up relief funds or collective brotherhood associations or craft guilds and all those kinds of things. the structure of social innovation and social entrepreneurship and social enterprise has been around a substantially long time. But what's interesting is that historically we would have described the advent of the social economy, for example, as, you know, post-Second World War, demise of the welfare state, on an incremental rise of social problems and needs within communities that the public sector can't simply provide for, and also the increased capitalization and globalization of the private sector. And so this space in between becomes where the sort of hotbed for the creation of social enterprises, right? That's historically how we described this space between the public sector and the private sector as the social economy. But I think what's changed, what I've noticed in particular that's changed significantly is, you know, with the advent of the internet, we've all become more personally aware of our own self-impact on the world and on our community. You know, we have access to open source data, we have online resources, we have sort of a mass acceptance now that the world's resources are finite and that we actually play a role in sustaining our communities and our local spaces. And so as we try and attempt to address these wicked problems, and now we have a personal sense of how we engage with those wicked problems, it seems to me that people just naturally are becoming more responsible in that way. So how we make our choices to buy something, how we make our choices in terms of how we vote, is now beginning to reflect our social responsibility in lots of ways. I find it fascinating now when I'm talking to students. I remember when I started teaching social innovation and social entrepreneurship in Trinity in 2009. And of course, you can picture what the political and economic situation was in Ireland at that point. We were in the process of having a major economic crash. And of course, Trinity at that time and the School of Business, where most of the graduates that were coming out were looking to go into the big corporates or the financial institutions and things like that. And so they saw my class advertised as social innovation, social entrepreneurship, and thought, well, I like the entrepreneurship part. I have no clue what the social part's going to involve, but I may not get a job in where I thought it was going to go. So maybe I should take this class. And the transition that I found from 2009 to now is that I have students who set up their social entrepreneurship project in high school. And they're now coming into my class to learn how to scale their social impact, how to grow it, you know, and how to achieve this social mission on a systemic scale. And it's just phenomenal to me that we've come through that. And I think it really is because of the internet and the open source data and this really deeply embedded sense with young people now that they have a social responsibility, and also that whatever career they choose, they don't have to set aside that sense of social responsibility. So they're looking for opportunities to bring their whole selves, what they believe in, how they want to behave, how they want to act as consumers in the world, into their jobs. And I think it's fascinating, Emer, with the pandemic, just to see how that even might become more intense.
Yes, I think we've had an opportunity to reflect a bit more on what kind of society we want to live in, or what kind of local communities, because we've been confined to our local communities during various lockdowns. I'm interested in the fact that you spoke about 2009 in Trinity and the career aims there, and then the career aims of the students that you have in Pennsylvania and the USA. Do you think there are big differences? There are a lot of similarities between what happens in Ireland, or what goes on in the mind of a student and a potential graduate in Ireland versus in the USA?
I think it's an interesting question. I should start by saying that I was working in the School of Business in Trinity College, Dublin, and I've come to a liberal arts college in Swarthmore with all undergraduate students. So there's already a different perspective in terms of how they're entering into their education and what they want to learn about and how they want to explore their education. In the School of Business, they're very much focused on business skill sets. And you know, exploring that world of management organization and perhaps entrepreneurship as a subset of that, or finance or marketing or whatever particular part of the discipline they want to look at. Here in Swarthmore, teaching liberal arts students, I could have students that are engineering students. I could have students that are science students. I have dancers in my class. I have students that are specializing in art history. So the breadth of interdisciplinary exchange in my class is so much richer and different in a way. That's not to say that it wasn't rich when I was in the School of Business in Trinity, but it was, you could understand that they were specifically focused on those kinds of, that's why they were there, right?
Well, there's also, that's the kind of structure that we have in Ireland, is that right. One does a degree in a particular discipline, although we're increasingly in Ireland providing courses that are more interdisciplinary. And they kind of help, that interdisciplinarity, I think, is something we should be fostering with students, and encouraging engineering students in our faculties of engineering to work with our business students, to work with our arts students, and so on. Yeah,
I would agree there. I would even suggest that there's more emphasis on them taking classes in those other disciplines and not just working with the students. You know, I've found that incredibly valuable here, to have a student's perspective on what does it mean, what does empathy mean from English literature perspective, coming into class and describing what that means. To someone who's an engineering student who's trying to create a prototype for a medical device, you know, and they have to understand who are the users of this product, what are their needs, how do I understand what their situation is so that I can design it most appropriately. So you have these wonderful crossover conversations. So I think that's probably my biggest takeaway from having come from the, like you said, the Irish education system, where we do tend to be siloed from 18 years old, which is just crazy. You know, you're siloed into these disciplines, you take classes within those, and you don't get a chance to expand out into sort of a more liberal arts perspective. Now, I suppose now that I'm in Swarthmore and I'm teaching social innovation, social entrepreneurship, when I do, for example, teach the social business model campus, I get a lot of students saying to me, oh, that's really fascinating. Could you, you know, almost teach me an MBA program, but in 6 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I consider me dipping your toe into the world of this, but you may have to think about taking another class that specializes in it someplace else.
You mentioned the social business model canvas, and we'll come to that in a few minutes, but I want to go back to two things that you mentioned earlier on. One of them is, you mentioned an author who had written a paper on the history of social innovation going back hundreds of years. What's the name of that author again?
De Fournier. I believe it's Jack De Fournier.
Fournier, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So he's a wonderful academic who's just written so much. He's really a foundational writer in this space.
In this field.
Yes. Yeah. From a historical perspective, but also he would have been involved. I mean, as you know, a lot of the early work in this space was around classifying the organizations that fit within the spectrum of the social economy. So Gregory Dees, Dennis Young, all of those people writing about who are they? What are they? What should we know about them? How do they behave? What kind of needs do they have? How do we scale and grow them? That kind of thing. And so De Fournier, and also Lester Salomon, and
Anne Heyer,
forgot his first name, you know, involved in all of that classification work. So if you look at a lot of the work around in various countries, they're looking at trying to describe the sector of the social economy in their country context, they'll usually refer to Dees, Young, Anne Heyer, and Salomon, and De Fournier.
And I think that's part of the issue that we have in Ireland at the moment, in that we only had a national social enterprise policy as of 2019. And, you know, teasing out those differences between a social enterprise and a charity, for example, how would you delineate between a charity and a social enterprise?
Right. So this is fascinating. This we could talk another 3 hours about this EMIR alone, and I will never come up with a definitive answer for you. What I often tell my students in a way to kind of simplify this, because this actually does refer to the differences in America, the United States, and also in other places around the world, not just Ireland, but Europe or other places. All of these organizations are driven by a social mission. That is their primary goal. That is their light at the end of the tunnel thing that they're trying to do. A charity will set out what their social mission is and create their social programs, and then find multiple different ways of bringing in income in order to sustain those social programs. And I describe to my students as a money in, money out kind of situation, right? So you cover your operations, you cover your staff, that's usually probably skeletal, you'll probably have a large number of volunteers, and you basically organize yourself in a way that sustains what you're doing without creating any kind of surplus or trying to maximize opportunities for anyone else outside of that group of beneficiaries that you have, right, that are recipients of the services of your social programs and ultimately your social mission. When you move into a social enterprise, what you're doing is by sort of creating the enterprise model onto your social mission and social programs, you're allowing yourself some autonomy over your income streams, right? So, you know, and it can be in various degrees, of course, right? We can have social enterprises that have a minimal amount of tradable income, but that tradable income does something towards achieving their social mission that's pretty critical to their organization. And sometimes it could even just be sustaining staff levels, right? You know, if you're a social enterprise, you know that if you're constantly chasing funding, it can be on very short-term cycles, maybe 1, 2, or 3 years. Whereas if you're able to generate your own tradable income that simply covers even the manager's salary, then you're not at risk of losing that person. And oftentimes the person and the people are the most critical components of a successful and sustainable social enterprise, whether you're a charity, a social enterprise, or social entrepreneurs, right? I tell my students, charities and nonprofits are typically money in, money out through fundraising, donors, you know, whatever it is it takes to bring the money in to run those social programs. A social enterprise starts to differentiate itself when they are able to generate some kind of autonomous income that allows them to do things that isn't controlled by anybody else. And then it goes up, right, all the way up, and depending on the degree to which you increase your tradable income.
Yeah. Can you give us a good example of a social enterprise on one or other side of the water?
Before I do that, can I just... Do you want me to talk a little bit about the differentiation? Because I think that's important to say. From a European perspective, we do acknowledge sort of this range of organizations that sit within what we call the social economy. So the charitable organizations and then the sort of companies limited by guarantee with charitable status. And then you maybe have blended hybrid models. And then you have just companies limited by guarantee that have a social intention. And it goes onwards from the public sector to the private sector. What's interesting about America, the United States of America here, that I have found, and I knew this before, but when you're actually here in the middle of it, it's so interesting. Most of the times, if someone asks me, what do I teach? I'll say social innovation, social entrepreneurship, and they'll say, what's that? And I'll have to say, well, I teach students how to create nonprofits. And they're like, oh, okay, I get it. But they automatically assume that I'm talking about charities rather than, you know, businesses that are driven by a social mission for social change. What's also fascinating within that is if you say nonprofits, there are some truly enormous nonprofits in America, like schools, hospitals, universities, you know, all of those are incorporated within this IRS classification system that we have here, which is the 501(c) classification that delineates the sort of nonprofit activity. And so you have nonprofit activity that to me is more sort of charitable oriented and less towards building in business or entrepreneurship models to self-sustain. And then on the other hand, you also have the whole sector really been driven by private funding, right? The private foundations, sometimes public foundations. But, you know, so you have these two pillars in the United States that sort of fund and maintain what they would, I guess, call the social economy here. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, there are increasingly some models of social enterprise. So you have flexible purpose companies, limited liability companies. You know, there are some states that are creating specific legal structures that would represent more of what we would describe as a social enterprise or the community interest company model, for example, in the United Kingdom. So we're starting to see pockets of that. But mostly people would say, oh, a nonprofit charity funded by a private foundation. So it's a different kind of space.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't quite got that far either here in Ireland in terms of what exactly a social enterprise is compared to a charity. But working with the definitions you've given of social enterprises, Can you give us an example, maybe one from Northern Ireland, from your work there in terms of peace and community development, or one in the US?
Yeah, so it's funny you say that. I was talking to someone yesterday. I started working in the peace process probably around 1995, 1996. So, you know, the peace agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, was signed in 1988. So I was still working pre-peace agreement. And one of the first projects that I worked with was former Republican prisoners taxi project. So they wanted to set up a taxi company, basically to provide employment opportunities for people that were coming out of prison that were having to readjust, just as you could imagine, any intermediary labor market project would do in that sense. And of course, you know, at that time, the peace process was very new. The peace program was very new. And, you know, there were a lot of questions about, well, what do you want the funding for? What are you going to do with this funding? Right. How can you tell us more about the group of people that you're trying to serve? And you can imagine in the context that we were working in at the time, those are fairly difficult questions to answer. And so we really had to try and build up a lot of trust with the funders and with the community also, to say that this project is going to do what it says, and here's what our intentions are, and here's the people involved, and all the rest of it. And so that was around 1995, 96. I remember going to the first funding meeting with them, for example, and getting lots of questions around what was our intentions with this project. Fast forward to a few weeks ago, and I just acted as their independent evaluator for a project that they're doing right now. And this group is just phenomenal. They've just done such incredible amount of work from those very beginnings of trying to create something for people coming out of prison to not go back into conflict. They ended up, you know, changing the law. They created a new taxi act in Northern Ireland. They created a regulation of the taxi industry and systems there. But beyond that, they create huge, enormous training programs for local communities. They support Indigenous business, not just taxi drivers, but lots of different kinds of businesses, hairdressers, and all sorts of people that are working in the local community. And during the COVID period time, did a phenomenal amount of work getting people from, you know, the gray or black economy into employment and into training and, you know, being secure. So it's just fascinating to me that sometimes people say, oh, you worked in the peace process. And I say, well, I kind of still do. There's no exit strategy when it comes to working with social enterprise. And I'm so glad, because they're phenomenal. And sure, you know, it's a great opportunity for me and an honor to be working with them and involved in that way. But that organization is, if you can imagine where they would sit on the social economy, you know, they're drawing down funding quite considerably from public grants and public funding, and working with all sorts of departments in the public sector also, and then separate funding programs that within Northern Ireland that support community and peace building and that kind of thing. And that has always been probably their primary economic model, although they then do also do accounting services for their clients that brings in a little bit of income that supports them also. Complete contrast from another example that I'll give you in the United States, which I got to visit about 2 years ago now, which is Mimi Silbert's Delancey Street. So Mimi Silbert is one of the Ashoka Fellows. She set up Delancey Street in sort of, I think, the late 1970s, early 1980s. She has a background in psychology herself, and she fell in love basically with a gentleman who she would describe as having lots of issues, and tried to rehabilitate him effectively. She has set up this organization that basically paroles people into her organization. It's a residential center. They live there for 2 years. It's completely peer training oriented. So people who graduate from Delancey Street are the people who run the programs and do the counseling services and all the rest of it. So talk about community and users knowing the best solutions. Mm-hmm. That's totally ingrained within the ethos of the Delancey Street model. But her funding mechanism is just so fascinating, because she doesn't take funding from any public sector source. Right? She basically creates a series of businesses that surround the residential center. And those businesses create income to maintain the nonprofit. And not only that, each of those businesses that she has, so for example, she has a catering business, she's most famous for the Christmas tree business that she has, they have a moving business, and all sorts of kinds of construction-oriented businesses, all of these generating income for the residential center. In addition to those businesses, she's created training schools. So each of the businesses will have actually training schools that support the activity of the business and also the rehabilitation center. So if you're someone coming into Delancey Street, you've been paroled out of prison, and they've given you this option for rehabilitation to go in. After about 2 weeks in the center, you're put to work. You're assessed and they say, okay, what do you want to do? What are you interested in? Here's the businesses that we have. You can start working in any of these. And by the way, if you need to get your GED, which is the high school qualification, then you can go to the training school and do that. So her businesses support the training schools and also the rehabilitation center. So, I mean, that model isn't necessarily the golden thing for social enterprise. I'm not saying that they should all go towards that direction where they're fully sustainable by their own tradable income, because that isn't necessarily beneficial to all social enterprises. Like the taxi company project that I talked about, they need to be able to work with the Department of Health and the Department of Employment and, you know, all sorts of things. And so having funding relationships with them is actually really, really important to them understanding what they're doing and who they're serving and all of that kind of thing. For Delancey Street, she less needs to work with stakeholders directly from a funding perspective. She obviously relates to the Department of Probation, Department, you know, the police and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it isn't core to how she sustains herself.
The two very interesting examples, and in both cases it's about people coming out of prison and finding it difficult to get employment. And I suppose it's not a million miles from the European model of worker integrated social enterprises, where the emphasis is on the workers, the employees, and their rehabilitation or their upskilling and so on. I come back to another point you made earlier on, and I'd like you to elaborate on it, as to the concept of wicked problems. And, you know, what do you mean by a wicked problem? It's not a term that's very well known in general.
Right.
How would you?
You start off by talking with a community organization and you say, well, what are the big issues that you have here? And they'll list off a ream of things. Antisocial behavior, lack of employment, lack of education, poverty, all of the kinds of things that snowball together to create what we would describe as a wicked problem. You know, a wicked problem is something that has multiple dimensions. There's lots of reasons why they exist. There's lots of viewpoints as to how they can be solved, right? They usually have a lot of stakeholders involved in all of them as well. So that makes it very complicated. And they usually require a substantial amount of money to fix, right? And you could, if you think of a wicked problem, sometimes you'll see the imagery for a wicked problem as like a big complicated ball of thread with lots of bits coming off it. And if you pull one of those successfully, does that mean that you're going to unravel the wicked problem completely, right? And sometimes when we talk about the work of social enterprise and social mission, we talk about eradicating these kinds of problems. And is that really something we can ever possibly achieve, given the complexity of what we're facing? So poverty is a wicked problem. Inequality is a wicked problem. Gender inequality is a subset of that wicked problem. Climate change is a wicked problem. So, you know, that's what I mean by that term.
But I suppose we could say that coming back to higher education, in terms of students or with teachers, lecturers, professors, if the students can nibble away at one tiny aspect of a wicked problem, they can learn a lot, and maybe there can be benefits from that in terms of the students learning or even making a significant difference to somebody's life,
right?
Not necessarily alleviating poverty worldwide. It's too wicked a problem.
It's too wicked of a problem. So I guess, there's a lot in what you've just said there that I could touch on. Certainly students understanding what is social innovation and what are the processes associated with social entrepreneurship, the principles, the underpinning principles of those concepts, to be able to do them well is really important. So that would be a priority for education. In terms of tackling and, as you'd said, nibbling away on wicked problems, I think what's really important is also from an education's perspective for students is to get them to understand and figure out how to model a system, right? What does that system mean, like system thinking? How do you do system thinking? How do you look at all of the stakeholders that are in associated with this wicked problem that you're investigating? And what role do they have? What kind of values do they have? What kind of boundaries do they have? What kind of influence do they have on the problem that you're trying to look at? And if you can look upstream in terms of those issues, what might be the sort of root causes? And how do you tackle those, right? So I think from an education perspective, getting students to understand that rather than jumping into a solution that they think is appropriate for a wicked problem, to really sort of step back and understand and learn about how do I map a system using systems thinking so that I can leverage what little I do in the most impactful way, working with all of the stakeholders associated who are also trying to tackle that issue.
Yeah. And in a way, what you've just said, Denise, brings us neatly to the social business model canvas. Mm-hmm. Students who've studied business studies will be familiar with the business model canvas. Mm-hmm. And then you took that one step further and said, well, what about social businesses?
Right.
So could you explain, number one, what the business model canvas is in your eyes, and then what the social business model canvas is?
Sure, absolutely. So I think probably at some point around the 2000s, maybe slightly earlier, I think business education and business thinking moved from this, you wrote this business plan that sort of predicted what you were going to do for the next 5 years, to a much faster, more flexible model for you to be able to envisage and also implement a business model vision that you had. And so I think Strategizer, who's the originators or owners of the business model canvas, decided that rather than having these lengthy documents that laid out all of these principles of business practice, that you should be able to envisage your business model on one page, using 9 boxes only, starting with the consumers of your potential product or service, understanding what they need, what their pain is, what kind of jobs they need to do and how they want to do them better, and create a value proposition that allows you to articulate what is the product or service that you're delivering. And then from that, decide, well, how am I going to get this product or solution to the customers? What's my channel, right? How will I continue to build great relationships with those individuals so that they become consistent and repeat customers? And then moving to the other parts of the business model canvas, which is, you know, who are the other partners that I need to work with? What kind of activities do I need to carry out to get this done? What kind of resources do I need? What's the bigger macro environmental picture telling me that I need to be aware of? What are the legal changes, the political, economic, social, technological, environmental, all of those kinds of things? And of course, the bottom line, what we describe as the bottom line in business, which is, you know, how am I going to generate revenue? Built within that, what will be my pricing structure for this product or service that I'm offering as a value proposition? And then what are my costs and how do I balance that, right? How do I balance the bottom line? So I'm not the first, I should say, to come up with a social business model canvas. There's been a number of different models that have existed before mine. And, you know, it's been interesting because I've probably been teaching the social business model canvas for about 10 years. And I've never really wholly liked any of the other models that I've been talking about. And a lot of times my classes would be ending and me saying, if I was doing this, I wouldn't have that, or I would change this, or I'd put more emphasis on this bit or whatever. And necessity is truly the mother of invention, to be fair, because when we went into lockdown in March of 2020, I was basically facing having to teach a class in the fall on my social business model, on the social business model canvas. And so I was hit with this, okay, now I have to teach a model that I don't really like, that's on paper to a group of students that are online virtually and can't work in teams easily. And in 1 week, literally, I was introduced to, I was taking a design thinking class with Stanford D-School, and they were using Mural. I had never heard of Mural before. And it just struck me that actually, here was something that I could create a template that would be my social business model canvas, everything that I believed should be included in it, on a platform that would allow students, no matter where they are in the world, to be able to contribute and collaborate together. And I think I spent a Friday afternoon, about 4 hours on a Friday afternoon, and I just wrote it down.
Good for you.
Because I was under pressure. I had to get it done. So I learned about Mural, and I reimagined my own social business model canvas in an afternoon. And it's been great, actually. I then taught it in the fall, and the students really enjoyed it. It worked really well. Obviously, there's some hiccups along the way, and you kind of amend and change them. But it's been really fantastic.
And what are the main differences between the strategizer, traditional, let's call it at this stage, business model canvas and your social business model canvas? We have them available on our website. Right. But what would you see as the difference?
And I'll add into that where I think some of the other social business model canvases were lacking, right?
Yes.
I suppose one of the first things is something that we've just touched on, which is this idea of systems thinking, the pre-work that you need to do before you get to deciding what your social business model is going to be, right? Mm-hmm. I think my experience with, and to be honest, I'm not saying it was anybody's fault. It was also my fault. I was teaching this myself when I was in the business school in Trinity, that students could just simply conceptualize a business with a social mission at the same time and didn't really have to look at this bigger picture, didn't really have to look at where can I leverage to push, you know, put my efforts in best. I think this is, maybe I'm going to slightly segue, but this is something that educators tend to do anyway, because we're trying to teach a specific thing over a short period of time, and we don't really have the latitude to kind of open it up and, you know, give this wider perspective. But now, for the social business model canvas, I think it's really important that I have a section in there that gets students to do systems thinking or the impact gap analysis. You might know Daniela Pappy-Thornton. She's just done this amazing work around understanding the gap.
We have a podcast with her as well.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
So I had a conversation with her. I told her I was creating this social business model canvas, and would she mind if I put her impact gap analysis as sort of like pre-stage one? And you know, her perspective was fascinating, because she was all absolutely, but no, and mentioned that then creating a social business could be one outcome, and of many others that someone could choose to do. From the impact gap analysis, right? So that was really interesting and wonderful for her to allow me to sort of reference her as a pre-step. Then the business model canvas and other social business model canvases, of course, then the next step is to look at who are your segments, who are your customers. And I always felt like I had to divide that up into not just customers, but beneficiaries and also funders. And so I did that, because I think those are the real critical stakeholders for a social enterprise or social entrepreneurs. Understand who your beneficiaries are, understand who your potential customers are, knowing that they could be the same or different. And then also the funders. Funders, for some reason, were ignored as a critical stakeholder. And I know from my history, you know, you cannot do any of this. And then you talk to the people who are potentially giving you money. Because invariably, you're also serving them and what their goals and social missions are. You know, so that was one of the biggest things that I changed. From that, then we went into the social value proposition, which is similar to the business model canvas. But in my case, I wanted to differentiate what is your social value proposition for your beneficiaries. And in that way, you're kind of describing what your social programs are, the additional activities that you'll create just for that group of beneficiaries. And then the customers, which is really kind of, if I sort of talk about this kind of cleanly right now, because it can get very complicated, the customers can be the people who buy your products and services from the business, right? And then your funders, what's the value proposition that you're creating for funders as well? So that kind of differentiation was really important. From that, you describe your social mission. ultimately what it is you want to achieve, what your goals. Interestingly, I couldn't really find a clean space on any other social business model canvas that had a place where people could articulate in less than 8 words what their social mission was. Right? Mm-hmm. Who are you working for? How are you going to do it? And how will you know whether you've achieved it or not? So that was kind of interesting. So at the top of my social business model canvas, I have what is your social mission? And then I also have what is the name of your social business? I think sometimes in my experience with students and with others, they tend to describe what they do and not why they do it. Right. And I wanted to make sure that that was clear. Why are you doing this is different to what you do.
Which is analogous to, you know, this is the product I have created and this is what it can do.
Right.
Well, to whom is that of any use, and how will they use it and why they use it?
I think probably the most basic social business model that I often describe to students is imagining that you're in a bus. And the chassis of the bus is your social mission. It stays constant. It's fixed and firm. It's the thing that's going to carry you to the end of your journey. The wheels mm-hmm. of the bus are interchangeable all the time, or the mechanics of yeah. the engine and all that sort of stuff. Those are the businesses, right? They change out depending on what the market needs, what the customers need, that kind of thing. Whatever's going to make you money to sustain the bus moving yes. forward, right? And if you know, so if you were to strip out the social business model canvas, that's the one I would describe. So we did systems thinking as a pre-step. We changed the segmentation from key stakeholders. We reflected that within the social value proposition. We created a space for social mission and the business. And then the next thing that I did, which was just always surprising to me that it was missing in a lot of these, was I created a dedicated column that asked you to articulate what your social measurement strategy would be. And I reflected that in the short term, medium term, and the long term. And so kind of like reflecting a theory of change. What do you want to see in the short term? What do you think is going to be positive impact for you to measure? What do you think the wider community is going to benefit from in the medium term? And then what is the systemic change that you want to achieve in the longer term? Mm. And the way that it's sort of articulated on the social business model canvas reflects across to beneficiaries, to customers, and to funders also.
Yeah.
So they're incorporated within that. Now, if you then go over to, you know, the other types of the boxes of the business model canvas and social business canvas, I have who are your key partners. Who are your key partners for the social programs and for the social business? What are the key activities for your social programs and for the social business? Likewise, resources. I also have a section on the macro environment, just like the original business model canvas. But I have included a section on competition and co-opetition, right? So, because that's what we find that's unique in our space, is that we are often working with other stakeholders who are trying to achieve a similar goal to us, contributing to the eradication of that wicked problem. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're in competition with them because maybe they're trying to serve the same beneficiaries or they're trying to work with the same donors and whatever. So mm-hmm. it's really getting students and others to think about how do we cooperate, even though we may remain in competition in different aspects.
It's very much that ecosystem of the system, as you say, where there are different parties there.
But... Right. And then the bottom line, I suppose, this looking at, you know, revenue and costs. Interestingly to me, a lot of the other social business model canvases never really asked for a breakdown of revenue. And to me, I don't really ever ask a social, if someone says to me, I'm a social entrepreneur or a social enterprise, I never say, what's your legal structure? I say, where do you get your revenue from? Because if they answer that question and they say, they list off 5 public sector donors and they say, but we also have this little business, then I, in my mind, can place them along a social economy continuum. I know who they are, what they do, why they do it, and how long they're going to need funding and how they operate, right? It tells me infinitely more than asking them what their legal structure is. And so in this My Social Business Model Canvas, there's actually an opportunity for you to create a pie chart that reflects the percentage incomes that you have from your diverse sources. Likewise, in the costs, you know, getting them to think about how much do I need to spend on the social programs I want to deliver to create the social change? And also, how much do I need to sustain the business? And to look at those two separately and then together. And then finally, there's a box in the middle for surplus profits. What are you going to do with this money if you generate a surplus? How will you reinvest it back into your social goals?
Yeah, which is your long-term mission of the social value proposition, or the long-term mission. Yeah, you've done a huge amount of work on that. And it takes a long time for students to absorb everything in a business model canvas, let alone a social business model canvas. What would you say are the biggest challenges students have in learning how to use this particular tool?
I often say to students, this isn't something you're going to do once, right? This social business model canvas is something you have to do multiple times. So the way that my social business model canvas is created on Mural, I have a little tip at the side of it, which says, you know, using blue post-its, write down what you absolutely know. Using green post-its, write down what you think you know, but you're going to have to do some research. And then use pink post-its to say, should I know more about this, right? And through each iteration of their Mural social business model canvas, they start to see the changing colors of the post-its. Ideally, you want to see more yellow, right?
Yes.
And it allows them to move those post-its around the social business model canvas collectively, as well as online, which is really useful, because you can you really get some great conversations with students to say, well, hold on, is this person a beneficiary or are they a customer? What do we really need to know about these beneficiaries to be able to serve them well? Mm-hmm. And if we're selling to our product and service to a customer that's actually, you know, not really part of the beneficiary of this social business, what does that mean? Who are they? Where are they? You know, how do we reach them? Each of the boxes that you work through. So I teach last semester, I taught this course over 12 weeks. And each week the students had to go back in, and having done their systems thinking and having explored who they are as inner social entrepreneurs and what they're passionate about, they had to then end with a revision of their social business model canvas each time.
Yeah, it took a whole semester.
Yeah.
For them to put together a canvas where they had gone from I think to I know, or I'm quite sure.
Right.
That this will work.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing that they'll never actually be there, that it's just this constant moving feast.
Yes. It's deceptively difficult, because this is all on one sheet. So students can often think, I can fill this in an hour before my class.
Right.
Whereas actually you're saying, no, this could take you 12 weeks to really nail it. Yes.
Right. So I would ask my students to save down their last version of the Mural, copy it, and start again with the next class. And what's cool about Mural, I mean, Silver Linings Era, Emers, you know, we complain about, oh gosh, so much tragedy has happened over the last year. This was the silver lining, because students could create a Google link within a box on a post-it that would open up to a Google document where they had put in all of their individual research that they'd done on the aspect that they were working on from the week before. And so you start to build this Google Drive repository of background information linked directly to their social business model canvas on Mural.
Yes. I sometimes use the analogy of a duck calmly swimming across a lake or the sea, but actually right underneath they're working away furiously, and there's a whole, you know, in their body they're using all their muscles and so on. There's a lot going on, even though it looks calm or serene.
I sometimes want to take the pressure off students also, because I'll say to them, just like the example of the taxi project I gave you, this could take 25 years. You've got 12 weeks. You know, our goal here is to teach you the underpinning philosophy and principles and practice of this, so that this example is just an idea. Don't feel the burden of having to create something that you'll go out and do. Especially when I was teaching this during the pandemic, we couldn't have community contact. And so it was really all theoretical. As an educator, my goal was to make sure that when they did it the next time and they had access, they could do it well, and they understood what the components of it were and how to do it.
In a way, anybody who's being entrepreneurial is dealing with uncertainty at all times.
Right.
they're comfortable with that uncertainty. They're comfortable with changing tack and so on. Mm. And that brings me to another question. In terms of skills or competencies, what do you think are the, you know, skills and competencies we need to foster in students so that they can be effective entrepreneurs or effective social entrepreneurs?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I had sort of thought about this a little, and I was thinking, if I was to take this from the perspective of another educator, what advice I would give them, say, for example,
yes.
The first one is to be open to an interdisciplinary approach for your students. Mm-hmm. Urge students to think wider beyond the disciplinary silo that they might be in whatever way that can be, whether it's bringing in guest academics who are specialists in similar themes in those spaces, like empathy, for example, which I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. I think look for colleagues who work in sciences or social sciences or humanities to understand the people that you're trying to serve. I think now, looking back from a business school perspective, I probably failed my students because I didn't emphasize the need to understand the key stakeholders, right? And to get close to them. Mm-hmm. And so that would be one thing that I would say. We tend to teach either the social or the entrepreneurship part. We really have to think a bit deeply about how those two things are interconnected. Mm-hmm. And society and social and community and people and the business. There are two different things, and we put them together in this concept of social entrepreneurship. So we have to be careful about that. I now only teach if I'm teaching through an engaged scholarship model. And what I mean by that is I always have to have a community partner as a co-designer and a co-delivery partner for my classes. So I would encourage anyone who's looking at this space to think about how to do that well for students, because it's just a completely different educational experience for students when they have someone from the community who can really give perspective and challenge students when they come up with ideas to say, do you know, that's a great idea, but here's how it's going to be challenging. And how does it fit within that mix of a wicked problem? That's really important. And it might mean, you know, partnering with some of the larger foundations that support social entrepreneurs, like Ashoka or the School Foundation or the Swab Foundation or others like that as well. I think one of the other things that I've come to appreciate much more now is different forms of knowledge, right? And that sometimes in academia, we tend to get very focused on what we believe is important knowledge, right? Or expert knowledge. Mm-hmm. And in fact, knowledge comes in many different forms. And people within the community are their own experts and have their own knowledge that we could never really, and you know, we couldn't expect it to necessarily be as expert as they are. And so when we're working with community partners, we have to understand that we're actually reflecting multiple different kinds of knowledge, and that's equally important. So the dynamic that you have with community partners and students and academia has to be an equal and reciprocal partnership.
Yeah, and they have the lived experience of whatever the wicked problem might be.
Exactly.
So exactly. I think the lived experience of a former prisoner, you mentioned two businesses earlier on, mm-hmm. That employ and train and help rehabilitate or provide a bridge for those people who are former prisoners on both sides of the Atlantic. Yeah, it's their lived experience is very different from ours.
Right. And the last thing I would say, if you're teaching social innovation and social entrepreneurship, is, and this is students also who are getting into this space, is that we have to appreciate that social innovation is actually delivered at multiple levels. So you could be developing social innovations that are focused entirely at the local grassroots level, right? Immediate social challenges experienced on the street that people have to create solutions for in usually a very short period of time, right? But social innovation also operates at the infrastructural level. So policy, you know, how do we create systems in our education, in our health, et cetera, in our government that allows us to facilitate social innovation for communities at the grassroots level. So, and then finally, systemic levels. How do we look at it globally? What is the macro picture of the role of social innovation in the world? And if you're trying to teach a class and you're trying, and students are trying to look at these wicked problems, inevitably they're going to have to reflect on how that wicked problem manifests itself at all three levels, and then decide which level of intervention do I want to work in.
Mm-hmm. Or which level can I work in at this stage?
Right, exactly.
Or in the context in which I'm operating.
So on the one hand, as an educator, you're saying, here are the basic principles, underlining theory that supports the practice and actions of these. And we've got a community partner who's helping us understand that in context, right? But at the same time, when you go to apply this next, you'll understand it's, you may be working at grassroots, you might be working at infrastructure, or you could be looking at it systemically. And so that's, but the principles still apply at all of those levels. They come with their own challenges and things you can do and need to do and understand how to do.
It's interesting that you talk about the three or four different levels, and obviously at a systems level or at a government level, those kind of changes that we want to bring about will take much longer, a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. But in terms of a local problem, it could be something that the students could learn under the guidance of their university lecturer in collaboration with the practitioners. You talk about an engaged scholarship, or the term I use is engaged innovation. Mm-hmm. That you have to engage fully with the beneficiaries, so the prisoners by analogy there, or the customers who are going to use the service, and so on. Have you any other useful frameworks or models that you use? You talk about the social business model canvas, and you teach that over 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the impact gap analysis that can be used, right, as a precursor to the social business model canvas. Are there any other tools, techniques that a lecturer who's toying with this or moving slowly into it could incorporate? Have you any ideas?
Sure.
There?
I mean, probably the most common one that I use in addition to those systems thinking and the social business model canvas would be design thinking or human-centered design. That is, yeah, a practice. Those toolkits that you use that encompass this idea of design thinking that allows students to completely upturn their perspectives and focus everything on designing for individuals and humans. So that, to me, that involves ethnographic research, for example, and all the different kinds of skill sets that are associated with that in order to design for others. I think that has been a challenge that we've had in the past, where we've asked students to come up with really cool ideas that they think would work in communities. And of course, that's going nowhere pretty quick. So to be able to understand, how do I do human-centered design really well?
Yeah.
And become a really good practitioner of that, then do your systems thinking.
Yes. Yes.
Not necessarily in any kind of chronological order, because we do all of these things at the same time.
Yeah.
And then when you get ready to, you feel like you've understood the system, you've understood the beneficiaries, the customers, and the funders, that you can then use the social business model canvas in a more appropriate way. I have another thing that I created, which is called the Engaged Scholarship Map. So when I was in Ireland, actually, at the time, we were looking at mapping out the sector in Ireland of the social economy. And I had wanted to create a map of social enterprises around Ireland. And of course, then I came here and I was working in this wonderful small liberal arts college. And it occurred to me that so many people were doing phenomenal things related to social change, but nobody really knew anything about it because they weren't communicating it effectively. So I created a map of the campus using Google Maps, where we could have building structures, and created pins of profiles for individuals who were doing really cool things relating to social change. And that's called the Engaged Scholarship Map. So that's something else I could share with you potentially if you're interested.
That would be great, because that's in my own work with the third sector, the social enterprise sector, in asking how can we collaborate better. It's a very basic question of, we don't know who to ask, we don't know who to contact, and we don't know how to go about it. So at DCU, we've had a number of matchmaking events, which were more about industry or for profit organizations engaging with the university. Mm-hmm. But your Engaged Scholarship Map could well be another way of creating that collaboration.
One thing it also does is it prevents us from over accessing community partners who get exhausted.
Yes.
You know, so if you've got 10 faculty across the campus who are all talking in the same community organization, they're like, can you just not have a conversation?
You know? Yes. Or how does this fit with my social mission in my organization? Oh. I don't have the bandwidth to be nearly servicing all these researchers. And that's, I think, one of the issues as well when we ask students to engage with the sector and understand properly the problem that they aim to solve is who's benefiting at the end of the day. Is it mainly student learning, or is the beneficiary, so the unemployed person, the low skilled person, whatever, are they benefiting in any way from interacting with our students?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a perennial problem
yes.
that we have. We've careered through a huge amount of material here now, Denise, and I'm very thankful for you to you for all of that. A few words of advice. What advice would you give to students who aspire to pursuing a career that involves social innovation or social entrepreneurship or social impact? What advice would you give students who care about an issue and want to do something about it?
Right. I would say anticipate spending a lot of time getting close to the problem. Right. Proximity to the problem is the most important piece of research and time that you will spend. If you're not from that community, if you're not necessarily familiar with some of the really intricate challenges that they face, the historical nuance of how that problem came about, who all of the stakeholders are, you know, what their motivations are, what their value sets are, all of those kinds of things, then whilst you might come up with something that's innovative that could be adopted by a community eventually, it won't be something that you necessarily would be able to find to root yourself in for a long time, I would say.
Yeah. Understand the problem very well before you develop your own, or while you develop your own solution.
Right. I think I have found students often want to create something new that's theirs. And I think that has gotten in the way sometimes of, because they've although they've acknowledged that there are other stakeholders out there doing similar things, trying to attract, you know, to deal with the wicked problem. You know, they're using different, similar kinds, for some reason, for their CV or for their resume or whatever it happens to be, students feel that they have to own it so that they can talk about it, so that they can whatever. And I would encourage them just to think hard about that, because sometimes they can actually leverage themselves into another organization and create a cumulative impact, as opposed to setting up something on their own that's probably not going to have the mileage or the critical mass that it needs to be able to create the change that they're aspiring to, right?
Aspiring to, yeah. And that's the students on one. That's very, very good advice, not to keep the problem and not to the solution and not to look at it as my own.
Right.
It won't go anywhere if you keep it too close.
Yeah.
And then coming to the educators in higher education, what advice would you give to higher level educators who would like to implement social entrepreneurship or social innovation somehow or other in their teaching? And I'm thinking in particular of disciplines that might naturally spring to mind. So, you know, why would somebody who teaches in a school of chemistry or a school of engineering or a school of history or English language literature do this, or how would they go about it? What tips would you have for them?
Right. So again, it's the importance of interdisciplinary perspectives in this space. You know, we have these two words, social, and we have entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurship will not create social change on its own. And you have to understand society and history and how people behave, psychology. You have to understand people's motivations and value sets and, you know, aspirations. And so in order to do that, you really kind of have to look across all of these humanities and social sciences kinds of studies to understand people, because people and community are at the heart of this, right? The entrepreneurship is just the wheels on the bus. So I think the direction that we're going, say from a higher education institution perspective, is that our consumers, who are our students, expect this to be integrated into their conversations across all of their classes. they, like an engineering student, expects to be able to design something that's meaningful, that's going to end climate change, that's going to eradicate poverty, that's going to contribute socially some way, positively. They are not separate as they used to be before, as much. And as an organization, as an institution, we should really be looking, you know, we have all of these corporate social responsibility kind of statements, or we have our sustainability goals. And so why not then encourage our interdisciplinary faculty to figure out ways to that they can represent social innovation and social entrepreneurship in their classes? I mean, we talked earlier about just how old this sector actually is. Even if you're studying Greek history, you can incorporate aspects of social innovation and social entrepreneurship there. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think sometimes the word entrepreneur, you know, which is to undertake something, to do something, venture is related to the word adventure, that a lot of these words and concepts maybe have become too closely associated with business schools at the expense of what they originally meant. And how social innovators, social entrepreneurs were originally the community leaders who were trying to develop a better society, a better community. Any parting words for us, Denise, before we finish this very interesting conversation?
I think it's an exciting time. I think we're at a tipping point. I mean, just like I said from the beginning, when I started teaching, students didn't know what this meant. Now we have thousands of students doing social innovation, social entrepreneurship, business planning competitions. We have so many students looking to do masters or PhDs now in social innovation, social entrepreneurship. The students that I talk to are looking to go into companies that, you know, match their value sets, mm-hmm. And what they want to do in terms of social impact. And that's a game changer for them in terms of recruitment. So I think we're in a good space. Like I said, I'm coming to the end of my 6-year visiting professorship, and I gave a lecture recently, and it was around global policy change and what was going on. And I hadn't looked at it in a while, and I was just fascinated with now how many countries have social innovation or social entrepreneurship policy documents, you know, and that are starting to recognize legal forms that support social entrepreneurs, right? And creating tax benefits, you know, which has always kind of been a sticking point. So that to me is, I'm really enthusiastic about it. And I think we're in a good place. I think that the concept of social innovation and social entrepreneurship will just become how we do what we do and how we do business. And that there won't be a differentiation between entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship. It'll all be entrepreneurship that will be mindful of social change and social impact.
And social good, yes, or positive social impact. Yes. Very good way to finish there, Denise. Thank you very much with that kind of global perspective of just standing back and saying, look, this is the way things are going worldwide. So thank you very much, Denise. And we look forward to welcoming you back to Ireland if you're on your way back home after your time in Swarthmore. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the From Passion to Action podcast. If you'd like to find out more about Denise's work on social innovation and social entrepreneurship education at Swarthmore College, you can visit the website at swarthmore.edu/social-innovation-lab.